Hello, everyone. It's Clay Jenkinson, the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. I have two Daves in this zone today.
You're so confused.
David Swenson, the permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and David Nicandri, my friend in Tacoma, Washington. And today, we're talking about the transit of Venus. If you follow the Jefferson Hour, you know that a number of weeks ago, we did a pre-transit of Venus broadcast with Jefferson talking to Nicandri. Today, the transit of Venus having come and gone on June 5th, 2012, we're doing an out-of-character transactions discussion of what we saw and what we think it meant. So, David Nicandri, welcome to this program, but say a little bit about this sort of double guest appearance you've made on the Jefferson Hour.
Well, it's been a great fun, Clay, and I've appreciated the opportunity really to frame my thinking about it. And being, as I kind of fashioned myself, the Jefferson Hour's reporter on the scene at two transit of Venus observation parties, to put a little too frivolous a cast to it. It was certainly great fun, but there was also more of a seriousness of purpose to it. Anyway, I appreciate being able to be a part of these two shows. And as I say, it's really helped frame my own thinking and level of engagement with this very exciting astronomical event.
Well, you know, David Nicandri, it's so much fun to have these conversations. We have a long history together of conversations about ideas. In fact, I dare say that we talk about virtually nothing less. I mean, we once in a while we say, do you like white beer rather than wheat beer, or do you prefer whiskey to scotch? But normally, our conversations are about the history of exploration, and I think what both of us have learned in the course of our recent career paths is that Lewis and Clark is a great story, but it's really best understood as a subset of a much, much, much larger history of exploration.
Completely agree, Clay. There were many calls in the previous generation of Lewis and Clark scholarship before our books to try to put the Lewis and Clark expedition into some context. And I dare say with great humility, I think the same could be said about Cook scholarship. There's a little bit of a self-enclosed micro-universe of Cook topics, and that's what I'm trying to do with my own study, perhaps broaden the perspective a little bit to include other tangents. On the one hand, these are much written about, much talked about topics, but there's always new avenues of approach as well.
You know, as a Lewis and Clark scholar, you got to go give lectures in places like Omaha and Louisville and even Charlottesville. But as a Cook scholar, I imagine you'll get to go to Tahiti and to Australia and New Zealand.
Well, I certainly have set aside as a goal, which is a concomitant aspect of my particular research interest on Cook, to get to the higher latitudes of Cook's explorations. I've already been to Alaska. I'd like to get into the Chukchi Sea. I'd like to visit the periphery of Antarctica. The Polynesian thing's kind of been done. There is what I call the, relative to Cook studies, the Polynesian palm tree paradigm. I'm a little bit of a contrarian, as you know, Clay, so I'm looking for the relevance of Cook in what might be called the higher latitudes.
Well, I'm for that. In this show that we're now about to let people listen to, you said something really extraordinary, and we didn't have time to go back to it, but I want us to focus on it the next time that we're together on this program. And that is that if Cook were alive today and he were trying to take his vessel from the Pacific Theater into the North Atlantic, the Northwest Passage is now open in an unprecedented way. I mean, can you just say one word about that?
Well, I'll make one brief comment about it. One of Cook's great contributions to geographic comprehension is that he delineated really the last unknown quadrant of the world's sphere, referring to the northwest coast of North America, and in fact was the one who first mapped the gap between Siberia and Alaska. And he was stymied by the Arctic ice pack that otherwise prevented him from sailing through the Northwest Passage, which now does exist. seasonally through the Northern Canadian archipelago. So the modern relevance to Cook, in my estimation, isn't the worked over ground of whether he was seen as a divine being and stuff that a lot of the anthropological community has arguably overworked. It's the new stories that the Cook experience tells us, and that's not his encounters with sand, but rather his encounters with ice.
We'll leave it at that. When we can get this together, I see the Jefferson Hour going on the road. David Nicandri, David Swenson, and I on a ferry going through the Northwest Passage in a broadcast remote from the highest reaches of the planet. That'll be a great day in the history of the Enlightenment. David Nicandri, thank you. David Swenson, and to all of our listeners, I hope you like this program as much as we do. If you do, contribute to the Jefferson Hour or send us your thoughts on our forum at jeffersonhour.org. But listen now, as the learned Enlightenment observer David Nicandri describes his day, June 5th, 2012, observing for the last time for anyone now listening, the transit of Venus.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with, or sometimes about, President Thomas Jefferson. And this week, we have a special guest joining us on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Seated across from me now is the Thomas Jefferson Hour creator, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Clay, would you like to introduce this week's special guest?
I'm very excited. David Nicandri is back. As our listeners know, David Nicandri is a Lewis and Clark scholar. He has a book published by the Dakota Institute Press called River of Promise, Lewis and Clark on the Columbia, published 2 years ago. But he also, one reason that we're such good friends, is that he's interested in exploration as a larger subject, not just Lewis and Clark, and he's currently working on what will become a book on Captain James Cook. And Captain James Cook, as you know, went to Tahiti in 1769 to observe the transit of Venus. We had a program recently in which we talked with Thomas Jefferson and David Nicandri about the transit of Venus and what it meant for the Enlightenment and what it might mean even in the early 21st century. And in the out-of-character portion of that program, I asked David Nicandri, who was going to observe it from the West Coast, if he would keep detailed records of that day, June 5th, 2012, while I kept records of my own observation of the transit here in North Dakota. And I'm happy to say he did that and had a successful observation of the transit, which is a rare thing, really, especially on the West Coast. So now we are joined by our friend who has, by the way, a large and growing Jefferson Hour following. There's a demand that we bring him back over and over again, so we're glad to do so. Welcome, David Nicandri.
Thanks, gentlemen. It's good to be with you both.
So let me ask this preliminary question. Did you or did you not see the transit of Venus?
I did. I should say the group or groups that I was a part of on two separate parts of the day did, and that was somewhat rare here in Western Washington. Because Tacoma, different parts of the city of Tacoma from which I was party to observation gatherings, we were kind of like an oasis of solar visibility, if I might call it that. It was to the great consternation of people in Seattle at the University of Washington and the Pacific Science Center in Seattle. It was a very cloudy, indeed rainy day. But at the southern end of Puget Sound, and I live at the very end of southern Puget Sound in the little community of Tumwater, in the morning it started, the fog began to burn off, as we phrase it here. But by mid-afternoon, it was quite clear, and although a rogue cloud would pass from time to time, we had excellent viewing of the transit from its commencement here, which was 3:06 Pacific Daylight Time until the sun set a little after 9. The transit was still in process, but was only visible after that juncture out over the Pacific in such places as Hawaii or Tahiti, indeed, Cook's old stomping grounds. But we had great viewing weather, and it was a great day all in all.
So you were in the southern Puget Sound at Tacoma, and you saw the transit. How far distance in miles is Seattle from Tacoma?
About 30 miles. And you wouldn't think the weather would have been that variable, but they were in fact quite distinct. In fact, there was a little bit of a phenomenon on the internet amongst the astronomical types, because it became apparent with these webcams and all the other technology we have that people could see that there was clear weather down south, looking at it from a Seattle vantage point. And so I won't suggest there was a constant stream of people, but indeed a large number, significant enough to matter, of folks migrated south from Seattle to get to a point where they could participate in the observation event.
And let me just stop to say something about that for just a minute, because that sounds like an easy thing to say. You know, the people were in Seattle, they had webcams or they had online resources that then caused them to get into their vehicles and drive physically down to Tacoma, where they were able actually to observe the transit. This is a very recent phenomenon, isn't it? In 1761 and 1769, you chose your spot, whether it was Philadelphia or Greenwich or Tahiti, and you either saw it or you didn't, and there wasn't a darn thing you could do about it if it were a cloudy day. And even in 1874, the most recent previous double transit, you would have had to choose your spot in advance and depend upon the vagaries of the weather once you were there. But now, thanks to the unbelievable instantaneous communications of our time and much advanced meteorology, you're saying that people in Seattle, one of America's great cities, could actually figure out in advance, if I want to see this thing, I'd better hightail it down to Tacoma.
Yes, it nevertheless entailed some effort, Clay. It took some people an hour and a half or longer to navigate through the traffic of Puget Sound, but that speaks to the a sense of commitment people had to participating in this great event. It's not like traveling halfway around the world like Cook and Banks did. But still, it required a commitment, and a significant number of people figured out where there was better weather, and they took it in. As you were recounting the difference between today and two centuries ago or more, Clay, of course, one immediately brings to mind poor Le Gentil, who you wrote about in your column, who missed it twice because he had bad weather or other wayward circumstances prevented him from taking in the transit, and he suffered a fate much like Edmund Halley, who just simply didn't live long enough to see it happen during his lifetime.
People can Google La Gentile, G-E-N-T-I-L, on Wikipedia or elsewhere and learn the story, but it's, in my opinion, a fate infinitely worse than Halley's, because Halley lived between transits, and therefore it never had the chance to even try to see one. But La Gentile from Paris went to India and the Philippines and back to India in 1761 and 1769, and eventually was gone for more than 11 years and wound up missing the transit both times. The first time in 1761, he was caught at sea on a stormy day, and so although he could see the sun and presumably make out Venus crossing it, none of his measurement devices could be used under such conditions. And then in 1769, he was in India, and it was cloudy. So eventually, he gets his way back to France after being gone 11 full years. And when he arrives, his wife had remarried, and he had been declared legally dead. Now that, I would say, is a difficult transit experience.
Gentlemen, we got some pretty interesting mail on the Jefferson Hour forum and at the website, and I'd like to share a couple of these letters. The first one came from Sid Easley, who I must take a moment to thank as a supporter of the Jefferson Hour.
He's
thank
an old
you very
friend
much.
Of mine from the Lewis and Clark Trail.
And from Kentucky.
Right, and his wife, by the way,
who he writes about,
is a binocular hoarder. On one of my cultural trips in Montana, they had two splendid... Nicandra, you'll know this. They had two splendid state-of-the-art binoculars that had double ways of being anchored to their body so they wouldn't jostle as they hiked. And at every time we stopped, they would take out these $3,000 pairs of binoculars and look at